1, 2, 3.
Today in the studio, the definitive live package from a true living legend.
Showtime. Okay, here we go.
So that's one of the great things for me about this tour, actually. It's like Sgt. Pepper, Hey Jude, Fool on the Hill, Gotta Get You in My Life, I think, Abbey Road medley. There's quite a few of them that we never got a chance to do with the Beatles. So they're coming up now like real fresh numbers. Even though they're probably older than the rest of the stuff, they feel fresher to me than some of the stuff I've been playing for the last few years. You know? So when like 50,000 of them show up all at once, it's pretty like overwhelming. It's like, here they all are. And somebody I was talking to said, we were all hugging each other. He said, well, you know, I don't ask you to do that, you know, but they just feel like that. So it really is very powerful. Hello, I'm Paul McCartney in the studio.
Good evening, New York City!
It's hard to sum up what that simple greeting meant to so many, coming from Paul McCartney, as he and his band took the stage for 3 nights in July 2009 to inaugurate the new Citi Field Stadium. Now, from the standpoint of the more than 105,000 fans who attended, this was the culmination of a 45-year love affair that the city had with McCartney's original band, The Beatles, who first landed in New York in February 1964 to do the Ed Sullivan TV show, then returned 18 months later to usher in the rock and roll stadium age by performing in the then-new Shea Stadium. When that landmark was scheduled for demolition, Paul McCartney appeared at the final show at Shea during a Billy Joel concert, coming full circle. Paul McCartney was chosen to christen the new Citi Field erected on the old Shea Stadium grounds. The Beatles' 1965 performance there has evolved from legend to rock mythology. So watching Paul McCartney tear into 34 songs leading his crack band has a certain bewildering effect. How does this real-life Dorian Gray do that? And after becoming one of the wealthiest entertainers in the world, being knighted by the Queen of England, and the tragic death of his first wife and bandmate Linda, why tour at all? Here's Paul McCartney with me to answer in the studio.
I need to tour just because when you make music, that's how you start out, with some form of touring, you know, little clubs. You then get bigger and bigger and bigger, like with the Beatles, and then you get to America, you get worldwide recognition, if you're lucky, you know. And we did all of that. So it's really a huge part of my life is touring. You know, it's something that I'm very used to. And lately I've kind of thought, well, you know, maybe I'll just make records and stuff and just hang out at home. That's nice too. You know, I like that too. But we a year or so ago, a couple of years ago, we said, well, you know, it might be really good to kind of get out and tour. And I must say, I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's something that I'm used to. I know, you know, I it's just kind of natural to me. And the real great thing, as you say, I don't need to do it to eat. But in a way, kind of spiritually, the feedback you get from the audience is very special. I mean, you make your records for the guy or the girl to put on when they get home, you know, whether it is they've got a vinyl CD or cassette or in the car or something. And you always make your records with that person in mind, kind of, you know, the fictitious listener that you're trying to please. So when like 50,000 of them show up all at once, it's pretty like overwhelming. It's like, here they all are. And somebody I was talking to said, we were all hugging each other. He said, and I was saying, well, you know, I don't ask you to do that, you know, but they just feel like that. So it really is very powerful.
Good evening, New York City!
Ask a girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby.
Wow, that's Paul McCartney with Drive My Car from the double CD and DVD package, Good Evening, New York City. The fact is that most of us never got to see the Beatles in concert during their brief touring years, which ended in August 1966. Most of us saw the Beatles one song at a time on a small black and white television. On the few live Beatle albums over the years, all you could hear was girls screaming because the band was amplified by the Shea Stadium PA system, used to announce which batter was up for the Mets Major League Baseball team. So frankly, I had to ask Paul McCartney if the Beatles were any good live.
The Beatles were like very special live. And it was, if you just took a straight musical analysis of it, I don't know what we'd score on a scale of 10. You know, I mean, we're always bad at exams, the whole bunch of us. We never did anything. You know, under pressure, we couldn't cut it. But it was more than that. You know, it wasn't just kind of, oh, he's a good guitar player, oh, he's a good drummer, oh, you know, he can play a bit of bass, oh, he sings good. It was the band. That was the great thing about the Beatles, yeah. And I've seen bands that I know are much more musically accomplished than we, as the Beatles, would have ever been. But we always could lick them. We could lick them, man. We never feared anyone. We could go on stage because we knew we'd been together so long. I mean, only in the early days we feared people because it was like, I mean, we used to get beaten by this woman incessantly. She played the spoons. I mean, this woman could just wipe us off any talent show in Liverpool. We used to look out for her. If she was there, we wouldn't go on if she was there. Because, you know, what happens is everyone gets tanked up about it at 11:30 and they go, hey, she's great. She's rattling these spoons. We go, bloody hell, this isn't R&B. But she won every time.
Oh, that was a great performance of Got to Get You Into My Life, as you'll see on the DVD of Good Evening New York City with Paul McCartney. Paul continues with his assessment of the Beatles as a live band.
There was quite a bit of intelligence in the group. It wasn't like exam type intelligence, but John was like a smart cookie. And, you know, I wasn't that thick. George, smart cookie too. And Ringo, who like went to school 3 days in his life. That's all he was ever in school, Ringo. He had some operation when he was a kid. He had like peritonitis. And, you know, any parents kind of know what that is. Like, kids die of that stuff. And in those days, this was a stomach thing. And he had this terrible thing. So, I mean, that was his joke, you know. And if everyone used to ask him about school, he said, I only went for 3 days, you know. Like, but he got this kind of worldliness about him, Ringo. He used to say, you know, studied at the University of Life, you know, it was one of those jobs. And it's true. He really is very kind of worldly guy, Ringo. So he kind of held us together in that direction. You know, and then I got into bass. I didn't like it at first, but then I started to see the melodic possibility, so I contributed a bit there. And then with the singing, John and I could always harmonize real good. We blended good. And then we were writing as well, you know. So, like I say, you know, if it was just a straight music contest, probably there were other bands that could beat us, but we always had these other little underlying subtle things that we knew would kind of carry us through.
The 1997 title song from the Paul McCartney album Flaming Pie, which started a decade-long run of 5 critically acclaimed studio albums. Paul McCartney has been such a cultural mainstay for so long that we forget the dues that he paid with the Beatles before they even got a record deal.
The Beatles had years of clubs before we ever got any kind of success. So when the time success hit, a record producer would come to us and he'd say, what do you want to record? And we said, well, what do you want to hear? You know, we've got 8 hours of it, man. Because, you know, after having work in Hamburg, we had about 8 hours repertoire of the Beatles. So for the first few albums, it was really, the first album was done in a day just because it was our stage act. We just, you know, Twist and Shout and all of that. That was just, the only thing we had to do was leave Twist and Shout till the end of the day because we knew John couldn't handle anything after he'd done that. And if you hear the record, he's like he's bleeding his vocal cords, you know. He's right up there, you know. And But, you know, it did mean that we had masses of material, masses of stuff available. Whereas I think the kids these days, they're lucky if they get one hit song. And then what do you do? How do you follow it up, you know? Whereas we were always aching to follow it up. Yeah, we've got better stuff, man. We wait till the next album. We'll really do this stuff. We'll get into the deep R&B stuff next album. Wow, you know, because our act used to consist of a lot of R&B B-sides. Because we didn't want to do the A-side because the other groups did the A-sides. So we always did like the B-sides that everyone threw away. But it was still a Bo Diddley song, or it was still a Buddy Holly song or something like that.
You tell lies and I can't see. You can't cry because you're laughing at me. I'm down. I'm down.
That song, I'm Down, was added to the New York City set list precisely because the Beatles had performed it at Shea Stadium in August 1965. You've got to see it on the DVD. Next, Paul McCartney identifies the glue that held the Beatles together, plus some startling facts concerning some of the biggest songs, and a musical tribute to boyhood friend John Lennon. For this and your other favorite rock star interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Paul McCartney for the double CD and DVD, Good Evening, New York City.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Paul McCartney with Redbeard himself.
Thank you, Sir Paul. It's an honor. There is an intense historical focus on the years 1967 through 1970 when the Beatles had stopped touring. Unfortunately, this tends to overshadow what Paul McCartney finds to be the best years of the band.
I think that's what became special, was the fact that we were a unit and we played together. And also we knew each other very well through having toured. And, you know, you're touring in the van and the window blows out, a stone hits it on the motorway and the front, and you're in the British winter. And it's really cold and fog and stuff. And we've got 200 miles to go to get from London to Liverpool. And I mean, talk about like we got to know each other. I mean, this one night I'm talking about, it really was like so cold, you would have just died if we hadn't done something. So what we ended up doing was we lay on top of each other. It was a little beetle sandwich. Literally four of us lying on the back of this van. But it was the only way we could do it, man, with the body heat. Because we were laughing hysterically as well, which helped. But this, our roadie just had to, you know, pull his hat down over his ears, man, and drive with this windscreen out, you know. So, you know what, all of those times when you get like a tough thing or a hard gig or something to do, or a big Royal Variety performance or something, or America the first time, you know, these things are like nerve-wracking. The fact that we knew each other so well. I think musically, I think you could have cast your doubts. Certainly Ringo wouldn't have ever played a drum solo for you. Number one, because he hated them, and probably number two, because he couldn't do it. But he hated them. He just hated drum solos, man. The only thing I ever got him to do was on Abbey Road. But he wouldn't have done that. George, I know George doesn't reckon himself as a guitar player. I've talked to him since the Beatles. You know, I said, you're good, man. You've got some great stuff going. He said, yeah, but so-and-so's Clapton's much better, you know. And I suppose if you're doing that kind of musical analysis, maybe Clapton has got, you know, slightly more chops than George. But I don't think that's what it was to do with, you know. I think that, like, the fact that Ringo held tempo great and was a real energetic personality kind of drummer. You know, yeah, that's what I love about drummers. I mean, forget anything else. If they hold time, and particularly these days with clicks and computers, you know, I love a drummer who can just hold time and just doesn't waver. And you've got to play to him. So many drummers will go fast if you go fast and slow if you... I hate that. So, you know, we had a lot of little subtle things that really made us good. Down in the jungle, living in a tent. You don't use money, you don't pay rent. You don't even know the time, but you don't mind.
Wow, in my opinion, an underappreciated chestnut from the 1973 Wings album Band on the Run, that's Mrs. Vanderbilt. From Good Evening New York City with Paul McCartney. Hard to believe, but even after 5 tours in the last 20 years, there's still famous Beatles songs that Paul McCartney has yet to perform live, which underscores the staggering depth of McCartney's catalog. Many of the Beatles' most famous songs were actually never performed live.
There are a few like that. Hey Jude, for instance, we never played. I only played it once after we recorded it, and then I never sang it after that, except to do the video. I think we did a live vocal on the video. I can't remember. It was a nice video to do, and we had a lot of fun. But after that, I never did it. The Beatles weren't touring anymore. There was never really anyone who sort of said to me, go on, give us a Jude, Paul. So I never had any call to do it, you know, and I didn't bother. So that's one of the great things for me about this tour, actually. It's like Sgt. Pepper, Hey Jude, Fool on the Hill, Gotta Get You My Life, I think, Abbey Road medley. There's quite a few of them that we never got a chance to do with the Beatles. So they're coming up now like real fresh numbers. Even though they're probably older than the rest of the stuff, they feel fresher to me than some of the stuff I've been playing for the last few years, you know.
We'll be right back.
That's a poignant tribute to his Liverpool school chum, John Lennon, who was gunned down outside his New York City residence in December 1980. McCartney also does a musical tribute to the late George Harrison and to his wife and bandmate of 30 years, Linda, a native New Yorker. Still to come, McCartney makes a case for going green. For this and other rock star interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for Paul McCartney's double CD and DVD, Good Evening, New York City.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Paul McCartney with Redbeard himself.
Thank you again, Sir Paul. Awareness is a prerequisite for activism. For instance, Paul McCartney's late wife and Wings bandmate Linda was a high-profile vegetarian and animal rights activist, and that awareness extended all the way to the day-to-day meals provided for the McCartney road crew on tour.
You know, it's our tour kind of thing. We're part of the promotion. So it really would go against everything we stand for if we had to buy in meat every day. So what happened was we said, look, anyone who wants to come to our canteen, it just happens to be vegetarian. In fact, we've got a lot of converts on the crew. They said, geez, I didn't know. I mean, half the people don't even know they're not eating meat, because it's pretty convincing, some of the stuff, particularly you can get from America, some real good stuff. Anyway, the promoter got back to me. He said, like you said, you've got some guys out there 6'7". I mean, these guys are pumped up, you know. They like, you know, they don't eat it. They just throw it in their heads, you know, and it's, you know. Kind of absorb it like a sponge. No, anyway, you know, and I said, well, I know about that. I said, I'll tell you what, though. I said, anyone who wants to eat like that, they're going to have to just pay for it themselves. That's the thing. So if they want to eat for nothing, will they eat vegetarian? I said, anyway, now here, hold on a minute. I said, what's the strongest, one of the strongest, nearest to man animals in the kingdom? What do you, like a male gorilla, you know, and you see in those programs, you see this guy pumped up with his steroids, those whacking great male gorillas. Well, they eat leaves. They're not carnivores, you know. So I said, well, I'll match any one of these riggers against my male gorilla any day. And, you know, you don't have to do that to be pumped up. It's a fallacy. But the thing is, you know, it's just because how we were all raised by our moms and dads. I'm the same. Linda was the same. You know, it's our tradition. And what's interesting is it's changing. Our traditions are changing. You know, half of what we know now didn't exist when we were kids. And so I think it's an interesting idea for the future, personally. You know, it's interesting on a lot of levels. You've got the economic level. You know, it's kind of, you know, you have to have like 3 fields of grain to actually, you know, feed cattle and stuff. Whereas, you know, if you had it direct, it's kind of cheaper and stuff. And there are a lot of very interesting facts like that from some of the people we meet. But, I mean, I don't want to go on about it heavily now, you know. But enough to say that we're veggies and have been for 20 years, raised all our kids on it. I'm very happy, you know.
Get back to where you once belonged. Get back. for you in a high heel shoes and a low neck sweater. Get back, little girl. Oh, get back, little girl. Yeah, now get back. Get back. Get back to where you once belong. Get back. Get back. Get back to where you once belong. Yeah, yeah. Get back. Yeah. Go home. Get back. Oh, yeah.
Getting Back with Paul McCartney from Good Evening New York City, double CD and DVD. And while Al Gore was just a relatively unknown senator from Tennessee, Paul McCartney saw something that truly galvanized his attention on the worldwide environmental issues of pollution, global warming, and conservation.
The scientists suddenly discovered this hole in the ozone layer. And I'm like everyone else, I saw it on the news, you know, and you go, oh, that doesn't look too clever. And I think it was the first time any of us realized physically what we're doing to the world. I think when you spray crops, you know, the farmers or the government scientists will say, no, there is no risk and do not worry. Yes, a few people have died, but, you know, and as long as it's not you or your family, you're not too worried and you can kind of put it off.
It's always the other guy.
It's always the other guy and it'll always get fixed. Right. Some government will come along. They'll fix
Who
it for
is
us.
They, right?
Well, you know, exactly. And then you suddenly realize, wait a minute, they didn't stop this 50-mile hole in the sky. Now, that sounds a bit dangerous to me. And the idea of suddenly the planet really taking a bit of a plummet and suddenly, you know, some of these things they've been saying for years actually coming to be, I suppose it kind of frightened me. You know, I've got four kids, and anyway, even if it wasn't for the kids, you know, I've got to breathe. So has the man from Exxon, and, you know, they've all got to breathe, and they've all got to live here. So we just thought, well, we're coming out on tour. It's going to be great. We're going to play to the people. We're going to be seeing our audiences smiling and having great fun and making music. But it'd be really nice if after the whole thing's over, we can kind of sit back on our farm where we live and say, hey, you know, we really did something else on this tour. We really made everywhere we've gone, we've had this message. And, you know, I've tried to not get it boring because, you know, I know it's a bit, these issues, you know, if you're a kid particularly, it's like, oh, my God, you know. Yeah. It really is spread bringing it home to other people, too. I mean, I don't think I'm alone in this. I think, you know, everywhere we go, even when we went to Japan, people said, well, look, it's not a popular thing out here, you know, because, like, they still go whaling and everything, and people are saying, save the whales. The Japanese are still out there, you know, gunning them down.
That's right.
You know. But I said, well, you know, it's tough. I'm still going to say it, and we'll see what happens. So I think it's got to come for us all, really, you know, and I'm just happy to be saying it. We don't really go on about it too much on the tour. I figure people want it anyway. But I'm just making sure the governments know that we want it. And there's a lot of reaction, apparently, in the governments and stuff. And I think, you know, in future elections, I think you'll see a lot of people voting for cleaning this place up.
Oh, I hope you're right. And
you know,
I really...
Well, come on, let's face it, man. You get a weekend off. You've worked hard all week. You go up to some canyon or something where there's a lake or something. And they suddenly, there's a thing posted, you can't swim in here. I mean, that's not
because
where we want to go, is
no,
it? You know?
No.
And I don't know anyone who wants to go in that direction. So I think, you know, we've got, probably, to my way of thinking, the most beautiful planet in the universe. I mean, I haven't seen anything better yet. You know, the moon's got a lot of yellow dust. Mars has got a lot of red dust. Off the others are like ice or, you know, gases and stuff. You couldn't even stand on them.
I guess we're stuck. And we got this, taking care of this one.
Look at this. We've got trees, you've got grass, you've got lakes, you've got this incredible mountain air or whatever. And so we mustn't goof it up. You know, it's just too precious.
Despite repeated warnings of dangers up ahead, the captain won't be listening to what's been said. He feels that there's a good chance
that we've been misled. And so the captain's planning to steer ahead. What can we do? What can we do? What can we do to stop this foolish plan going through? What can we do? What can we do? Despite repeated warnings from those who want to know, well, he's got his own agenda, and so he'll go. Those who shout the loudest may not always be the smartest, but they have their proudest moments right before they fall. Red sky in morning doesn't ever seem to face him, but a sailor's warning signal should concern us all. Whoa.
Stop him, grab the keys and lock him up. If we can do it. changes up ahead. Well, the captain wasn't listening to what was said.
Paul McCartney's global warming tour de force called despite repeated warnings from his 2018 album, Egypt Station. Watching Paul McCartney inaugurating the massive Citi Field Stadium by energetically ripping into 34 songs with this great band, it seems positively inconceivable that this is the same person that performed the same function at Shea Stadium 44 years earlier. The world in general, and New York City in particular, has changed in profound ways over that time. So I asked Paul McCartney how much the long and winding road has changed him.
Not as much as I would have thought, actually. You know, I expected at some point to grow up. This has not happened. Rather fortunately, if you ask me.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, I don't see an awful lot of point in sort of so-called growing up. You know, it all is getting serious and getting mad at everyone. I mean, I've still got a lot of what maybe some other people would call childish interests, you know, like my music. I'm still as into it as I was when I was 15 and younger than that. In fact, you know, our kids are sometimes saying to us, look, Dad, I mean, you're supposed to be like the straight ones.
You're making us
We're
look bad,
supposed
right?
to be. You know, they say, look, you look, you're the hippies, you guys. You know, what is all this? And I say, well, hang loose, chill out, be all right, you know, be cool. In fact, we got a great relationship with them. We're lucky, actually. You know, they're real good kids. And it's, I think, you know, just you kind of can understand young people a little better, maybe. You know, if you're lucky to have some good kids and you're a parent. What I love is there's never been any big weird thing on the music front, which I expected there to be.
And who could have predicted in their wildest imagination that the top-selling musical act in the 21st century would be a band that first came to New York City in February 1964 for a guest shot on the Ed Sullivan TV show? And with the Beatles rock band, the talk of the video game world, I had to know if Paul McCartney had any regrets about his Beatles experience.
The Beatles is a great band, and it's a shame that like all things, you know, it had to come to an end. But having said that, you know, I mean, I regret that it didn't keep going. But things that anybody did, no, not really. I had a ball. It was great, you know. And then I've been amazingly lucky since, you know. I've had this kind of thing with Wings, which, like, did great. And then I've had this kind of third, you know, life, really, with the new band. Which is, it's beautiful, you know, and we're having a ball. We're just enjoying it. I mean, there were a lot of things, you know, where people kind of saying, oh, you're following the Beatles, or you've got to be as good as Wings and stuff. But we just kind of bit the bullet, as they said, and just said, let's just get a band. Let's just really try and be good. Let's get a nice selection of songs. Let's just commit to it and go and do it. And it's worked out.
Everybody gonna dance tonight. Everybody gonna feel all right. Everybody gonna dance around tonight. Everybody gonna dance around. Everybody gonna hit the ground. So everybody gonna dance around tonight. Well, you can come on my place if you want to. You can do anything you wanna do. Everybody gonna dance tonight. Everybody gonna feel alright. Everybody gonna dance around tonight. Well, you can come over my place if you want to. love tonight. Everybody gonna feel alright. Everybody gonna dance around tonight. Everybody gonna jump and shout. Everybody gonna sing it out. Everybody gonna dance around tonight. You can come on to my place if you want to. You can do anything you wanna do. Tonight, everybody gonna feel alright. Everybody gonna dance around tonight. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everybody gonna dance around tonight. Everybody gonna feel alright tonight.
Originally from 2007's album Memory Almost Full, that's Paul McCartney recalling his early skiffle roots with the song Dance Tonight. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking the incomparable Sir Paul McCartney. What an honor. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.